All right, welcome back to the Deep Dive. You guys have really sent us some thought-provoking material this time, documents that really delve deep into the world of money and banking.
Yeah, it's one of those areas that can feel a little, well, opaque sometimes, right? Like you're peering through a fog trying to make sense of it all.
Exactly. And that's precisely why we're here today, to clear away some of that fog. Our goal with this deep dive is to really extract those core insights, those essential principles that make this whole financial system tick.
We've got this rich tapestry of information to work with, and we're going to distill it down to the stuff that truly matters.
I mean, think about it, right? That piece of paper in your wallet.
Yeah.
What actually gives it its power? It's a question that's always kind of bugged me. And then there's this whole idea of banks creating money. It sounds almost like alchemy, doesn't it?
It does have that mysterious aura about it. But fear not, we're going to break it all down in a way that hopefully makes it crystal clear and, dare I say, even a little bit fun.
So where do we even begin with something as massive as money and banking?
Well, I think a good starting point is to define what we actually mean by money. Our sources are pretty consistent on this. They describe it as officially issued legal tender. You know, the tangible stuff, banknotes and coins that we use every day.
Right, the physical cash. So it's more than just like IOUs or something, right? It's the official recognized medium of exchange.
Exactly. It's what everyone generally accepts as payment for goods and services and for settling those IOUs or debts, as we more formally call them.
Okay, that makes sense. But it's not just about the cash we physically carry around these days, is it?
You're absolutely right. Our sources also make sure to mention negotiable instruments like checks. I know, a bit old school in this digital age, but they still have their place in the system.
Yeah, true. So we've got the physical cash and these, let's call them stand-ins for cash. But why does any of this even matter? What makes money so fundamental to, well, everything?
That's where those four key purposes of money come into play. They're like the cornerstones of why this whole thing works.
Lay it on me. What are these pillars of the financial universe?
All right, first and foremost, money facilitates exchange. Just imagine a world without it, you're back to bartering.
Oh man, trading my extra tomatoes for a haircut, that doesn't sound very efficient.
Not at all. And our sources even use this term, the double coincidence of wants. You've not only got to find someone who needs what you have, but also someone who has what you want. And all at the same time.
Talk about finding a needle in a haystack.
Money just completely bypasses all that hassle. You know you can sell your tomatoes for money and then use that money to buy literally anything else you need.
So it's like this universal language that everyone in the market speaks. Okay, what's purpose number two?
Number two is money as a store of value. I catch a bunch of fish, but I can't eat them all before they go bad. Instead of my fish rotting, I trade them for money, which I can then hold on to and use later when I need something else.
Makes sense. So my wealth doesn't just vanish because, you know, fish have a shelf life.
Precisely. You've stored your wealth in a form that's hopefully more durable. But here's a little caveat. Our sources are very clear about this. The value of that stored money can erode over time. That's the pesky reality of inflation. What you could buy with a dollar today might cost you more next year.
Oh yeah, inflation. It's like a silent thief chipping away at your savings.
Mm.
Okay, what's the third big purpose of money?
The third one is money acting as a unit of account. It's basically the yardstick we use to measure economic value. It allows us to compare apples and oranges, so to speak, or maybe the cost of a bicycle versus a week's worth of groceries.
Right. It gives us a common language for pricing things and keeping track of our finances. Otherwise, it would just be complete chaos trying to figure out relative values.
Exactly. It brings order to the economic universe. Okay, and last but not least, we have money as a standard of deferred payment.
This one sounds a bit more complex.
It's really about enabling transactions that involve credit or paying later. Think of it this way. You're buying a house, but you don't have hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash right now. You take out a mortgage. That's essentially a promise to pay back the money over time.
Ah, so it's like a contract for future payment that's backed by money, even though the money isn't physically changing hands right now.
Exactly. Loans, bonds, installment plans, they all rely on this function of money as a standard of deferred payment. It greases the wheels of the whole credit system.
Gotcha. So those four key rules, medium of exchange, store of value, unit of account, and standard of deferred payment, they form the foundation of why money is so darn important. But our sources don't stop there. They jump into these important financial concepts. The first one that caught my eye was near money. What exactly is that all about?
Near money is a fascinating concept. It refers to assets that aren't quite cash in your hand or in your checking account, but can be converted into cash incredibly quickly and with little to no loss in value.
So it's like money that's almost, but not quite there yet.
Yeah, think of it like having your spare change in a piggy bank. Not quite as readily available as the bills in your wallet, but you can easily smash it open and get to that money when you need it.
Okay, I can picture that. The examples here mention things like short-term treasury bills and bonds. So it's like having your financial resources parked just outside, ready to be brought in at a moment's notice.
Exactly. And the reason why understanding this is so important is because it ties into the concept of liquidity. That's another big one.
Ah, yes, liquidity. I've heard that term thrown around a lot. What's the gist?
Liquidity essentially refers to how easily you can convert an asset or even a whole business into cold, hard cash to meet those short-term financial obligations that always seem to pop up.
Gotcha. So high liquidity means you've got easy access to cash when you need it. Low liquidity, not so much.
Precisely. And this has huge implications in the real world. Think about it. For an individual, having high liquidity means you can easily cover those unexpected bills, like a medical emergency or a car repair. For a business, it means they can readily pay their employees, their suppliers, keep the lights on. Without sufficient liquidity, even if you have valuable assets in the long run, you could be in real trouble in the short term. Imagine owning a valuable piece of real estate but not having enough cash to cover your payroll next week. That's a liquidity crunch.
Yikes, that paints a pretty vivid picture. Okay, so we've got near money and liquidity. What's the last of these key concepts?
The final one is liabilities. It's a word we hear all the time in financial discussions, but it's worth taking a moment to really understand what it means.
All right, break it down for us. What are liabilities?
In the simplest terms, liabilities are debts or financial obligations that you or an institution owes to others. They represent future outflows of cash. Think of it like this. You took out a loan, you've got to pay that back. Those are liabilities. You bought supplies for your business on credit. Those are liabilities. You issued bonds to raise capital. Yep, you guessed it. Those are liabilities.
So while liquidity is about how easily you can get your hands on cash, liabilities are about the claims that others have on your cash or assets down the road.
Precisely. And understanding this is crucial because a healthy financial situation, whether it's for a person, a company, or even a government, is all about striking a balance between what you own your assets and what you owe your liabilities. And of course, making sure you've got enough liquid assets to comfortably meet those short-term liabilities as they come due.
Okay, I'm starting to see how all these pieces fit together. We've got a grasp on money itself and these core concepts that surround it. Now, let's talk about the institutions that really make this whole financial world go round. First up, commercial banks. What exactly are they and what do they do?
Commercial banks are those financial institutions that most of us interact with on a regular basis. They're kind of like the central hubs of our financial lives. They offer a whole range of services, accepting deposits, providing loans, offering investment products, you name it.
Yeah, they're the familiar places we go to deposit our paychecks or to get a loan for a car or a house. Let's break down their main functions, starting with accepting deposits. What are the different types they handle?
Our sources highlight a few main ones. First, we have savings deposits. These are generally designed for smaller savers and usually come with a bit of interest earned on the money you've deposited. Then there are fixed deposits, sometimes called time deposits. Here, you agree to keep your money with the bank for a set period, like a year or two, and in return, you get a higher interest rate compared to a regular savings account.
And the last type mentioned is current deposits. I think these are more commonly known as checking accounts, right?
You got it. These are the accounts that are designed for frequent transactions, mostly used by businesses and individuals who need to move money around quickly. And our sources point out that they often come with overdraft facilities.
Ah, the overdraft. That little safety net that lets you spend a bit more than you have in your account, but usually with some fees attached.
Exactly. Now, moving on to the second primary function of banks, providing loans. This is a major way they generate income by charging interest on the money they lend out.
It's like the flip side of accepting deposits, right? They take in money from savers and then lend a portion of it out to borrowers, profiting from the difference in interest rates. Seems like a pretty straightforward business model.
It does, but there's a fascinating twist here that our sources emphasize. And it has to do with this function called credit creation, which they say is unique to banks.
Credit creation. Okay, now we're getting into the really intriguing stuff. What's that all about?
This is where things get a little mind-bending. It turns out that banks don't just act as simple intermediaries, lending out the exact same cash that someone else deposited. Through this mechanism called fractional reserve banking, they can actually create new credit. And that, in turn, increases the overall money supply in the economy.
Hold on, let me wrap my head around that. So if I deposit, say, $100 into my account, the bank isn't necessarily lending out that exact same $100 to someone else.
You got it. Banks are generally required to keep a certain percentage of their deposits in reserve, ready to meet the demands of depositors who want to withdraw their money. But the rest, the excess reserves, can be lent out. And here's the kicker. When that loan is dispersed and deposited into another account, that bank can then lend out a fraction of that new deposit, and so on and so on. It creates this multiplier effect, leading to the creation of new credit within the system.
Wow. So banks aren't just these passive vaults holding our money. They're actually playing an active role in expanding the amount of money circulating in the economy.
Yeah.
That's a pretty powerful function.
It is. And as you can imagine, it comes with certain risks, too. If not managed carefully by both banks and borrowers, this credit creation process can lead to bubbles and financial instability. It's one of the key things that economists and regulators keep a close eye on.
Okay, that makes sense. It's a delicate balance between stimulating economic activity and making sure the whole system doesn't get out of control. Now, beyond these core functions, our sources also list several secondary functions of commercial banks. What are some of the things they do on the side, so to speak?
Yeah, they wear a lot of different hats. A common one is offering locker facilities, you know, those secure boxes where you can store valuables and important documents. Then there's dealing in foreign exchange, which is a crucial service for businesses involved in international trade.
Right, if a company wants to import goods from another country, they'll need to convert their currency into the currency of the seller.
Exactly. But only banks that are authorized by the central bank can handle those foreign exchange transactions. Then you've got the exchange of securities, where banks act as intermediaries for their customers in buying and selling things like government bonds or shares of companies. It's like providing brokerage services for their clients.
So, helping people invest their money. What about this one? Discounting bills of exchange. That sounds a bit more niche.
It is a more specialized service. Think of a bill of exchange like a kind of post-dated check. It represents a future payment that a business is expecting to receive. The bank can purchase this bill from the business before its maturity date, but at a discount. This gives the business immediate cash flow, and the bank profits from the difference when the bill is finally paid.
Ah, so it's a way for businesses to get their hands on cash more quickly based on future income they're expecting.
Smart. And finally, there's this broad category of banks acting as an agent. What does that encompass? This covers a wide range of services that banks offer to make their customers' lives easier. Things like paying bills automatically, managing investments on behalf of clients, handling the financial aspects of estates, and facilitating all those electronic transactions that have become so ubiquitous these days.
So it's like they're providing this invisible infrastructure for so much of our economic activity.
Precisely. They're deeply embedded in the smooth functioning of our day-to-day lives. Now let's shift gears and talk about the big kahuna, the institution that sits right at the top of the banking pyramid, the central bank. What's its role in all of this?
Yeah, the central bank. It sounds powerful, almost mysterious. What does it actually do?
The central bank is like the conductor of the entire financial orchestra. It's the national monetary authority that oversees the whole banking system. Our sources break down its key responsibilities as regulating commercial banks, controlling the money supply, and implementing monetary policy. And crucially, it's usually the only institution that can issue the national currency.
Wow, it's like the guardian of the entire financial realm. Let's unpack those functions a bit more, starting with issuing currency.
That's the one most people are familiar with. The central bank has the exclusive right to print banknotes and mint coins, the legal tender that we use every day. This monopoly ensures uniformity and control over the physical money supply.
So they're the ones who decide how much cash is actually out there in circulation. What about regulating commercial banks? How does that work in practice?
This is all about ensuring stability and safety within the financial system. The central bank sets the rules of the game, the regulations and guidelines that commercial banks have to follow. They also monitor banks' financial health and practices to prevent failures and protect people's deposits.
It's like they're the referees, making sure everyone is playing by the rules and that no one gets too reckless.
Exactly. And this leads us to the central bank's next big role, maintaining financial stability. They're the ones who step in to prevent or manage financial crises.
So they're like the firefighters of the financial world. rushing in when things get out of control.
In a sense, yes. They can provide emergency liquidity to banks that are struggling, and they work to create conditions that promote overall economic growth and stability. They're the ones trying to prevent the whole system from collapsing.
Okay, that's reassuring to know. What about this function, acting as a banker to the government? What's involved in that?
It's pretty much what it sounds like. Just as commercial banks serve individuals and businesses, the central bank provides banking services to the government. They manage the government's accounts, handle public debt, and oversee the country's foreign currency and gold reserves.
So it's like the government's personal financial advisor and manager. And finally, there's the one we hear about all the time in the news, monetary policy. What exactly does that involve?
This is the central bank's big tool for trying to steer the overall economy. They use it to manage things like inflation, interest rates, and the money supply.
Right, we're always hearing about the Fed raising or lowering interest rates. Our sources mentioned some specific monetary policy tools: the repo rate, the reverse repo rate, and the cash reserve ratio. Can you give us a quick rundown of what those are and how they work?
Of course. The repo rate is the interest rate at which commercial banks can borrow money from the central bank. When the central bank lowers the repo rate, borrowing becomes cheaper for commercial banks, and that can trickle down to lower interest rates for businesses and consumers, potentially boosting the economy. Raising the repo rate can have the opposite effect, making borrowing more expensive, which can help to cool down inflation. The reverse repo rate is basically the flip side. It's the rate at which commercial banks can lend their surplus funds to the central bank. And then you've got the cash reserve ratio, or CRR, which is the percentage of a bank's deposits that they're required to hold in reserve with the central bank. By changing this ratio, the central bank can directly influence how much money banks have available to lend out.
So it's like they have these levers they can pull to adjust the flow of money and credit in the economy. Fascinating stuff. Our sources also touch on this concept of central bank independence, using the Bank of England and its 2% inflation target as an example. Why is independence seen as so important?
It all boils down to trying to keep those big economic decisions, especially setting interest rates and monetary policy, shielded from short-term political pressures. The idea is that an independent central bank can make the tough calls that are good for the long-term health of the economy, even if they're not popular in the short term, like raising interest rates to combat inflation, even if it might make some people unhappy.
It makes sense. No one wants politicians meddling with interest rates just to win the next election.
Exactly. And the Bank of England's inflation target is a great example of how this independence plays out. They've got this clear, publicly stated goal to keep inflation at 2%. And they're free to pursue that goal without being swayed by political whims.
Well, this has been a truly eye-opening deep dive. We've covered so much ground, from the very definition of money to the inner workings of central banks.
We have. It's amazing how intricate and interconnected it all is, isn't it?
It really is. And I think one of the biggest takeaways for me is that the decisions made by these institutions, the commercial banks and the central banks, have a real impact on all our lives, even if we don't always realize it.
Absolutely. They influence everything from the interest rates we pay on our mortgages to the prices we see in the supermarket. And it brings us to a question that I think is worth pondering as we wrap up. Given the power that commercial banks have to create credit and the crucial role that central banks play in safeguarding financial stability, what are some of the big debates and challenges that lie ahead for our financial systems? It's a constantly evolving landscape, and understanding these fundamental principles is just the first step in navigating it thoughtfully.
That's a great point, something we all need to be thinking about. Thanks for joining me on this deep dive.
It's been a pleasure. Always fascinating to delve into the world of money and banking.
Until next time.
See you then.